Thanks for joining us for part two of Navy innovator Ray Montague on Anchored in History, Stories of America's Navy. We continue the conversation with Dr. David Montague and Dr. Regina Akers, where we learn more about Ray's design of the Oliver Hazard Perry-class ship. Then, hear Ray one final time discuss overcoming obstacles and the mentorship she provided others, Dr. Akers' contribution to the new NHHC publication, U.S. Navy and Innovation, 20th Century Case Studies, and close with the upcoming minting of Ray's legacy. Before we continue, I need to restate that the views expressed by our guest are those of their own, not those of Naval History and Heritage Command, the U.S. Navy, or the U.S. government, and do not imply an endorsement of them or any entity they represent. Picking up where we left off on the last podcast about Ray and the overnight ship design, did she ever go into any discussion about what it took to do the Oliver Hazard Perry class ship design in the 18 hours and 26 minutes?
Yeah, I mean, she's, excuse me for coughing. You know, she talked about, of course, that, and she's been recorded many times giving the story of what happened. But I think one of the things that stands out to me about that is, here again, you know, that we talked about a rough project, the ship specification project, you know, and you heard her on the audio clip say, now give me a real ship, and was denied that. And she was not happy about that. She had revolutionized something on paper, but then they put the kibosh on it, and it could have laid just dormant. She was ready to go look for some other opportunity, you know, in the Navy, hopefully, right? And then, as things would have it, just the odds, the sheer irony that she wasn't thankful there was a war going on,
right?
But she was thankful that somebody heard the word. Mm-hmm. That meant that somebody at the Navy, somebody, and we never really talked about that, but somebody had to have spread the word, mm-hmm, that there was some person who had come up with something, mm-hmm, that might be able to help the whole country, mm-hmm, right? And word got out, and you know how things go. It's just somebody back then had not only found out, but they carried it to the point where the Navy brass shows up unannounced at NAVC and wants to find out who this young lady is, mm-hmm, who's done this project. And that's kind of how that whole thing was. I think that was one of the more astonishing things, that once people got involved and momentum was there, it was really her show. The obstacles weren't there. And I think one of the interesting things that, for me, is a good takeaway for that whole overnight code revolutionary thing that happened, was that in that moment, especially being denied the opportunity to have a real ship initially, when the opportunity came, she was still thinking about the mission, right? She was still thinking about what's best for this country and for really helping things. And she was very candid and honest and said, you know, if I can't do this thing over the weekend, I'm not going to need your whole month that you're giving me to do this project. There's a guy named Peter Nordhaus, and he talks about leadership and followership. And I think it's important. I do think my mother was a very good leader in many ways. And basically it talks about everyone's good at something. You can lead on something, you know, like in terms of skill set. You might not have the managerial skills and know how to do the communication and read people well enough to know and understand things, but you got some. But you can't be the expert on everything, right? And that's why followership, mm-hmm, is just as important, to be okay with kind of saying, no, you step in because you'll do a better job and it's going to help accomplish the goal. So I think that for that overnight code, for me, the thing that really stands out about that is that when she was in her moment, she could have tried to just selfishly held on to that time, thinking some other thing would pop up too or whatever, more notoriety, whatever. She didn't care about that. She wanted to know that she could actually do it, and then was willing to say, all right, I got my shot, and yay or nay, I'm willing to let the chips fall where they may. And I think that was a big sign about her character.
We'll hear from her one last time as she shares lessons from her career about mentoring and overcoming obstacles in her path.
Do all you can to open doors for other people.
Don't be like the queen bee. Get to the top and pull the ladder up behind you. Open doors. Mentor people. I mentor even at the prison. I have a PowerPoint presentation that I do called Changing Obstacles into Challenging Situations. An obstacle is when they say you can't. You might have to drop back and go a different way, a different route, and it'll take you longer. But you can still achieve and in many cases excel. And I want people to know, don't take you can't for an answer. It's just an obstacle in your path. Make it a challenging situation and find a way around it. Don't be negative about it. Plus the fact you don't hate people. When they try to do the dirty stuff, if you let that fester, they're controlling you. But if you can smile sweetly and say, what can I do to help you? You're controlling them because they can't figure out what's wrong with her.
That is so true.
Mm-hmm. Ray talks about lifting people up and helping others. But one of the things that I found that will forever have a lasting impact is that she was doing STEM. And I don't know if you'll want to go into this, David, but she was creating STEM programs before STEM is what it is today.
Thank you for sharing that audio clip. It brings back a lot of memories, you know, and she was very active, obviously, and with others in trying to make sure that the world that she and others lived in was not going to be the same world for people behind. And I remember seeing a poster that as a child in the house, just it was just laying against the wall. She had like images of ships and things and that she would get as gifts and souvenirs, I should say. But one of them was a poster of, it says Ray Montague and Dorothy Height speaking. And it was at the GSA, the General Services Administration, about opportunities for women in the sciences. And so that was a form of government program geared to adults. But my point is that, you know, she was a fierce advocate of being involved with numerous partnerships and doing individual work. You know, she was a member of Alpha Kappa Alpha sorority. She pledged in 1954 in Arkansas while doing all those other things that we talked about before, but also a proud member of the Lynx Incorporated, which is a group of professional women. They call themselves LinkedIn Friendship. That's how I met my wife, actually, because my mother-in-law is in the Lynx, and they're charter members of the Prince George's County, Maryland chapter, as a matter of fact. And examples of things to what you're talking about, Clifford, they would, you know, pool their resources and opportunities to get access to venues like Capitol Hill and, you know, have career days for high schoolers and junior high schoolers and K through 12 to be able to come and meet professionals in various areas, including STEM. And those were doors that they didn't have any formal programming about it, no big agenda. It's just we're bringing, and they would make all the arrangements, but they would donate the money to feed everybody. And if there was a cost for the space, they just paid for it as a group. They were using their resources, but they were touching the minds and the hearts of so many people. And as Gina talked about before, my mother was a firm believer that, you know, even though a lot of people had issues with or put up obstacles, as my mother called them, she never believed that she should not open doors for other people. And she didn't care what you look like. She didn't care where you came from, what you believed in. As long as you were willing to, you know, work hard and be receptive of an opportunity, she at least wanted to try to provide access to it. And like I said, it wasn't just her. There are numerous other people that have the same mindset to do it. So yes, they were doing STEM programming before STEM became a real thing. You know what I mean? And of course, now I think one of the greatest gifts that she could have received, I'll call it a gift, is when she later relocated back to Arkansas to live in Arkansas with us. And she was able to see that Arkansas has very, very strong STEM programming, especially coding classes for girls. And so she you know, even in retirement, continued, as Gina talked about, she did public speaking everywhere. And you heard my mom on the audio clip talking about going into prisons. But she was really, really passionate about trying to make sure that she changed the landscape of what opportunities are there. So I think, and she understood that was very important for people, especially if they're coming from different socioeconomic or geographic barriers that are, that still exist for a lot of people. And so she got a chance to see that as a reality. And going back to what we talked about earlier in our conversation, she wasn't supposed to take shop, you know, and now girls are being encouraged to take STEM classes and camps. And even my child has been exposed to STEM camp in Arkansas. But those opportunities are different now. There's still challenges, a lot of them. But for her to be able to see that much progress happen in her lifetime was one of the highlights in terms of STEM education. Now, and I will say that there are several scholarships in her name around the country, and one in Oklahoma, but she would travel around everywhere and speak as often as she could, you know, and even when it impacted her physically to the point right before she went into the hospital and then hospice, she told me, she said that was, she realized that's more important than what she did in her career, more important than the overnight code, it's more important than if she's able to inspire other people, that was worth it for her, even with declining health, to be able to send that message.
So she left a lasting impact on not only the Navy, but the lives of many others as well. But before we started the podcast, you had mentioned that Ray would do some journaling for others, right?
A lot of people in my neighborhood growing up, and we lived in what's, it's the K-Wood area of Washington, D.C., Northeast originally, and then moved in the 60s to, I guess it's called Adelphi, Maryland now, but it was called Hydesville, mm-hmm. Maryland, mm-hmm. when I was, or West Hydesville, when I was growing up, right over the Washington, D.C. line. And most of the people in my neighborhood, they knew she worked for the Navy. They had really no clue. She didn't talk about overnight code or ship design management. She didn't talk. They knew she traveled a lot, and she knew a lot about technology. But my mother was a very good conversationalist. And people, what I found out, in fact, later, and we were writing our book, you know, in particular, it became even more important or more known to me, is that a lot of people in my neighborhood, they just saw her as that person that listens and the person we can go to and empathize with and we can seek advice from. And they happen to know a lot about technology, by the way. You know, she was exposed to a lot of things. And I grew up in a mixed neighborhood at Hydesville, Maryland area. So you had a lot of people from different backgrounds. There was a lot of diversity in our neighborhood growing up. And again, it didn't matter. People would come by, and I would wonder, and I asked my grandma, why are they coming by the house? I'm thinking, like, I don't play with their kid. I don't, you know, we all kids, you know, would go play outside. And so what I realized later is that because people felt comfortable with her, she was working with them, and she saw it as a service for her to talk to them about the logistics of what it would be to do an obituary, which is a very difficult time for family members. And so I saw people coming to the house and doing it. And then I saw family friends that weren't in my neighborhood coming to do the same thing. And I was like, what is going on? Because it kept happening for years. And so what I didn't realize until we were actually working on the book was how many of them she had done. And I found a file cabinet with several hundred obituaries. And so to me, I think the technology is important about knowing how, when I say technology, the importance of thinking what to say and formatting and things. But that's a difficult time for anyone who's lost a relative to kind of think through those things. And then back then, you know, you can always go to the funeral home and have them work with you. But if you feel close enough to somebody to have a more personal connection, I think a lot of people would prefer to do that. So she had no charge. She always volunteered for every service. But I think that she thought of that as a very private, because she didn't talk about it, and personal way to give back to other people. And it was just really interesting to learn the depth of her doing that. I guess you could call it a hobby, but I think she really felt that it was the service part of it to help other people and give back that she could be very proud of. No one could define that for her. She defined that service for herself. And I think that was probably why she liked it so much.
That's quite a unique way to give back to others, and even more impressive the amount of family she helped in their time of grieving, to kind of build on her legacy that she's left behind. Her personal papers are now with the University of Arkansas. Is that correct, David?
Right. That specifically, well, there's 19 institutions within the University of Arkansas system, and the papers are at the Arkansas Center for History and Culture, which is part of the University of Arkansas Little Rock. So I'm happy to say that we have been looking at donating her papers to another archival facility that's in Little Rock, and it was going great. And then the associate provost, Deborah Baldwin, and I used to report to her when I used to run the online office for the university. You know, Arkansas Women. I forgot what the award was, but it was basically for high achieving women in Arkansas. It's every year.
Talking about when she was inducted into the Hall of Fame.
Not the Black Hall of Fame, but the Arkansas Women's Hall of Fame. That's what it was. Mm-hmm. She was inducted into both, but we were at the Arkansas Women's Hall of Fame. Thank you. Mm-hmm. And Deborah or Dr. Baldwin and I were talking and just kind of, you know, getting ready to walk in the event, and my mother was there with us, and then I was talking to her about this other, I won't name the other in the place, the archival facility, but they're friendly neighbors. So I'll just say that they both had the same mission, you know, they just report to different folks. And finally, Deborah said, you know, David, you ought to, you know, would your mom be interested in maybe, you work at UA, we call my where I work UALR, would you mm-hmm. be interested in doing that? I mean, keep it in the family, you know? Mm-hmm. And I was familiar with her facility from another project. And so I said, you know what? I think that'd be great, but you have to see what she thinks. And so I proposed the idea to her and took her down there to check it out. And the papers are there now. And so we've actually donated textual records, photographic, audio clips, things like that. Donated her sorority paddle and sweater. She got so many awards over the years, but she she helped Morehouse College, where I went to college, set up an ROTC program, Naval ROTC for the first time back in the 80s. And so I donated that. And it just feels good to know that that facility is there. And anybody can go online to University of Arkansas Little Rock, and you'll be able to find it. It's called the Arkansas Center. I wrote it down. Arkansas Center for History and Culture. And they have the Ray Montague collection. And that you can actually do a digital search for a lot of the records that have been digitized now and see some of the images of the ships. But I think more importantly, we donated copies of some of her speeches.
Wonderful.
And actually some of her PowerPoints and things of that nature where she was presenting technical things. And I think I donated a few published articles that she wrote as well. But that's where everything is right now.
That's awesome that folks can now go back in and look when they've got time at what she was doing and the legacy she was creating.
One other thing with that, Cliff, though, that I'm so glad you said that, because it's important for your listeners to know that several young kids found material for their elementary school projects online at the Ray Montague Collection and have then reached out to say, can I interview you? Can I do this, you know, type of thing? That is the best feeling to know that little kids are now going out and doing this type of thing.
That.
She would just
love it.
As she used to say, can you believe it? I'm sorry, I had to add that in.
It's just amazing to me everything that she did for everybody else.
Yeah.
What motivated her to do all of that?
Well, you know, it goes back to, you know, Gina talked very well about the family. You know, my mother was exposed to a lot of very strong women, strong African-American, successful women. And I think that they really kind of engendered in her this importance of, you're not doing all this by yourself. You're going to put your work in. But this is not at all because you're just so wonderful. Then it's a combination of what other people have put in you as well and opportunities. You know, Gina mentioned, you know, Betty Holberton, you know, the Wally Dietrich and others, mm-hmm. so many other people that mentored who were not African-American, right, mm-hmm. that helped open doors. And she was a firm believer that you can work as hard as you want. You're not going to open every single door in your life by yourself. You're going to have some help. at some point. So she was, it was very important to her, I think, to be able to do the same thing that other people did for her, because those people didn't have my relatives and friends in the neighborhood and that, you know, and colleagues at Carter Rock, the Naval Surface Warfare Center, her colleagues, even though she dealt with problems in her career, her coworkers, some of them were really close to her and did what was right. And the clear example that, you know, was when they went down to Woody's or Woodward and Lothrop department store for lunch, which a lot of people did at the time. And the server didn't want to serve her because she was black and said the other people, the other coworkers can come in. And so the other coworker said, oh, no. We're all going to leave. And then they went back to Carter Rock and told or encouraged everybody, cut up your credit cards for that company because they don't support all people. And Ray is part of us. That's a powerful message. Mm-hmm. So I think that those types of things, I think, really showed her, because the Navy was the only professional job she ever had, 34 years, right? And I think that was a powerful thing, that to give back to others and make this world a better place is more important. It's the most important thing that you can do as a person. So I think she just really got that from so many angles, but especially going back to those strong women that provided that foundation for her to kind of give her the guidance and life lessons to do that.
Gina, what was it like for you to research Ray for NHHC's publication, U.S. Navy and Innovation, 20th Century Case Studies, and to write the chapter about her?
In one word, amazing. I spoke with a colleague at NAVC, Naval Sea Systems Command, who introduced me to Ray Montague, and we were at lunch. And the more she talked, the more interested I got, and the more research I did. It was, historians don't always pick their projects. They're usually selected for us and assigned. But this is one that I was very grateful to have gotten to explore her life. And I really wanted to understand not only what she did, how she did it, what motivated it. And then as I learned about the obstacles, how was she able to turn those obstacles into challenges? So those were some of the questions that was driving my research. And then that took me to, having learned that much, why are we still talking about Ray Montague? Well, it's because of the things we've talked about today that we're still talking about her, that went far beyond the career. And I'm glad you stated it that way, that the career is important, but she really, really wanted to make any place she was better. And the lessons that she can still teach us today, I think that's just as critical. She was very much encouraged as a child. You know, that's a reminder to us. We need to encourage the children in our communities, and even if it's not in your community, admonish kids, remind them that they can do anything. Her elementary school teacher, when she said she wanted to be an engineer, the kids laughed at her, but that teacher took the time to pull her apart and say, shoot for the stars, because at the very least, you'll fall amongst them. Which reminds us of the importance of our teachers in our society and the significant role they have in our children's lives. They spend more time a week with our kids than we do, right? About 40 hours plus, depending on the age group. So many things like that, as I think about her and her life and her legacy, her ability to endure, her commitment. She was zoned in on what she wanted to do and how she wanted to do it. And that, again, speaks a lot of just her character, that she was able to do that with all of this going on about her. She was able to do it. I mean, she briefed the Joint Chiefs of Staff. How many people in any Navy career can say, oh, yeah, you know, yeah, I briefed them. They call me in.
Yeah, monthly.
And your mom could say that.
Monthly.
Yes. She could very much say that. Right? And an irony I find with her and other pioneers, regardless of the racial demographic or gender demographic, is sometimes those people who are your hardest opponents can become your advocates.
Yeah.
Whatever their perceptions are of, in this case, an African-American woman, because of Ray did what she did, I would like to think another part of her legacy is making those persons challenge the traditional beliefs that they had about women, about African-Americans, or about how anybody other than a white male could perform well in the engineering field because they encountered Ray Montague. And I think that's powerful.
Were there any challenges in telling Ray's story?
Challenges. As a historian, you always wish you had more time to write. But you have deadlines for publications. Ooh. I enjoyed her so much. I didn't want to stop researching her life and her career. And then David and Paige wrote this wonderful book, which I have shared with others. Like I said, they don't have to be in STEM, but for the lessons learned you can take from her life and career,
right?
I've shared that with other people so that they might get that as well. But no, there are lots of, so I wasn't aware of the papers at the time, because books, as they say, when they're published, they're old. And they are, because it takes, you have to go through that process. And so we started this process with Dr. Lupke as our editor, 3 years ago? And we just finally found out that it is forthcoming now. We'll actually see it.
Yes.
But now that I know the papers are there, though, I'm encouraged to do an article or something else about her, you know, to learn more about her through the papers and maybe talking with David more and things like that. But no, there's a lot of sources out there about her. She did an awful lot of interviews. And not just with chips, don't think of it just with computer or NAVC news or nothing like that. A lot of periodicals and papers interviewed her. And of course, the big thing was the GMA interview.
Right.
That was huge. You know, to have Janae Monáe there, right?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that was huge.
Yeah.
And that sparked more about her. So there were sources there, which I was very fortunate for, because that's not always the case when you're doing research. And then because of what she did, the multitude of Navy records that were available. So I loved it. And I'm amazed with her. I'm even more amazed and appreciative of her and all that she accomplished, even today. So I look forward to doing more work with her life and career.
Great. Back in February of 2024, the Navy dedicated a building at Naval Warfare Center Carter Rock in Ray's name, and it was for all the contributions she did for naval engineering. But alluding to something I said in the opening of the podcast by the minting of her legacy, she's also been selected to be part of the U.S. Mint's American Innovation $1 coin program. How does this make you feel about her contributions to the Navy and society overall?
Of course, it's amazing. I remember when I first received the letter from Admiral Lisa Franchetti and found out that was one of the things that was first on her plate of course, many other things, I'm sure, when she was over that facility and a few others, I believe. And I think she's moved on to another position higher up now, too.
Chief of Naval Operations.
Yeah, Chief of Naval Operations. So thank you, Admiral. I appreciate it. But I was just, because it's not a one-person effort, too, because you have to, she's able to do the push and keep it moving. But there were so many people involved in that process. And to think people were really doing this for a person, you know, and I thought it's my mother. And then to kind of bring it home, I brought my family up for that dedication as well. And so my wife and my child was just, I mean, that hit me the hardest, that to for her to walk in, it used to be called building number 40, and now it's called the Ray Montague Center for Maritime Technology. And to walk in there and see in the lobby this entire timeline display on the wall that goes for like 30 feet from left to right with all these different things that, you know, my kid's grandmother, that my mother did, was just, we were all blown away, you know, me, my wife, everybody, you know, I think everybody who was there for that dedication ceremony. So it was really surreal in many ways, because the building dedication is at Carter Rock, and that's where my mother got her start, you know, kind of like in Hidden Figures, where they worked in the computer lab. You know, my mother worked in the applied mathematics lab at Carter Rock, and I spent early part of my childhood running around the facility, you know. So it was just really a surreal and amazing thing to think, here's another legacy that, and as to go to what my mother used to feel, her career wasn't the thing that defined her. She felt her commitment to doing what's right and leaving the world a better place is what's more important. Career along the way, if that's what helps to provide the engine to get it going, fine. But I think with seeing that building dedication happen and knowing that it's a conference center and that future people are going to be inspired by it, really, I think, carries forth that legacy. And what was really more important to her is not just the flowers of people knowing her, it's what can it do to spark future innovators to go out and do these things? Same thing with the coin that's going to come out. The person from the United States Mint came to the dedication ceremony and walked up and said, guess what? You can announce that the Secretary of the Treasury signed it. It's official. You can say it now. It's because I've been working with them for a while. And to pick a design and stuff like that. They let family members help out. And we had some challenges in that process too. But to know there's going to be a dollar coin put out is just amazing, you know. And so I don't even know what else I can say about how beautiful it is. But I think if it continues to carry on her legacy, that's what her dying wish was. So that's a true honor.
So David, can you give the listeners some background on the process of Ray being selected for the American Innovation Coin Program and possibly some of the steps that you went through?
Oh, yes. Yeah. So, yes, the process was actually a very interesting process. I have to really commend the people at the United States Mint for really being very particular about how they did this. It's a very complex process. There's ideas, then there's artist renderings. I learned a lot going through this. The fact that they allowed me to be a part of this process, to even give ideas. And I'm sure for them, they probably deal with some folks that either don't want their family member to be represented in a coin or whatever, or are very excited and I would be upset if their recommendations are not there. My thing was just to be considered as an honor, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And so, and I will say that process, you know, going from rendering to then having discussions with me about what suggestions, they did have to make some corrections to make sure everything would fit for some, there's some legal things connected with it. There were about 6 or 7 initial artist renderings that we mm-hmm. looked at. Then coming back and then having discussion about those with the commission at the U.S. Mint. And then they were very courteous and respectful, asking what my preferences were and why. And understanding that I should have to understand that I can't tell them what they're going to do. It's their, and then at the end of the day, even if they decide on it, it's still got to be signed by the Secretary of the Treasury. But I'll have to say that I thought it was this part of this process, I think I really admire how the United States Mint was very compassionate in the way they dealt with my family on this. And you're dealing with so many things. At the end of the day, you're talking about putting someone's image on something that's going to be circulated all over the world, you know? Mm-hmm. So even though it's an honor and everything, I think it goes to people don't have to always be nice, but they were very nice about it. They were very professional. And I really appreciate the fact that they went to so much trouble to include our family in this process, understanding that it's only recommendation. Mm-hmm. So it was a multi-part process that went probably about 7 or 8 months, at least my involvement in it. But when the U.S. Mint reached out and they wanted to know if we wanted to let us know that they were looking at an Arkansas coin to come out in 25, and it's being considered, it's not mm-hmm. a definite. And my first reaction was, how can I help? I'll give you photos, I'll get you whatever, you know, I'll be willing to work with the art. They were like, hey, can you work with our artists? And this was like a process that went along for many, many months. Mm-hmm. And then I went to a virtual live hearing with the commission that approves these. Mm-hmm. And that went great. And then about a month later, 2 months later, there was a big public kind of, well, I say public, but it was a nationwide virtual, and had some people in a big face-to-face room. You can see mm-hmm. a camera. And they said Microsoft Teams. And they gave me a slot to be ready to be able to give testimony to the public decision, the vote.
Wow.
That would then go to the Secretary of the Treasury. And mind you, we worked with the attorneys on everything and wanted to know if we could modify. And so all I could do is recommend things. And I gave suggestions from several renderings that the artists mm-hmm. did and so forth. And they finally went with this one. And I had to kind of, they asked me why I wanted to justify this one versus the other ones. And so, see, they had them with different names on mm-hmm. them. And my point is that when the different people were going around giving their opinion about it, everything was very positive. And then all of a sudden, one guy who was there in person, and you can see the camera move over on him, and he says, well, I'm just going to be quite honest. I just think this is a inappropriate discussion. That's what he said, inappropriate. And I think that this is, no offense to the family, but I do not think that Ray Montague, though she accomplished a lot, is really worthy of our dollar coin program. Quite frankly, I think she might be more worthy of our quarter coin program.
No, he didn't.
So I started thinking Plessy versus Ferguson, right. You know, three-fifths. Yeah. I said, not even three-fifths, just right. A quarter. And, you know, that it would be, and he said it would be an insult to the American people, and described this image right here as her looking down on the Lilliputians in Gulliver's Travels, tormenting over them. Oh, this isn't a meeting, a public meeting. Because there's people listening that are going to be talking about other coins, and I'm, you know. And so I just sat there because, you know, I work at a university, which is a different kind of environment. And we have a lot of people with strong opinions, right? And I'm just sitting there looking. And finally, he says, well, I'm not going to be a party to this. And he gets up, and you can see him walk out of the room. And it was one of those moments. And I said, I wish she could be here right now and see this. And all of a sudden, I said, does anybody else have any comment? And they said, okay, are we ready to vote? And they just moved on, and everybody unanimously voted it in. But that, I thought that was interesting, how would she react if there was this one person who's just so adamant, referring to her as a giant, you know, looming over the Lilliputians on a ship, instead of saying that she's, because I looked at this as her honoring, you know, and they got a computer graphic in the background there for the sea. Mm-hmm. And it kind of reminded, and I told them, I said, that the thing that made this such an interesting project, the coin project, was that my mother introduced me to coin collecting as a child. And so I've got an invitation to go to the U.S. Mint, and we used to go to the Bureau of Engraving and Printing around the corner here as a kid, you know, watch them make the money. Mm-hmm. I just thought that was interesting how you've always got just one, at least one person who just wants to just derail something. And even on this project, as it really should be just positive. It's not about something negative. It's like, okay, what image should we do it? What kind of thing? For him, it was just a total insult to even have her considered as being even worthy of this and suggesting a lower denomination amount. Mm-hmm. You know, so I don't know if that's supposed to be for less distribution or if it's supposed to be less value.
Probably less value.
So I don't know how you.
But he made no difference.
He made no difference. And I thought it was hilarious. And we got off the phone, the call. I had to kind of sit to myself and just kind of reflect on that. And I remember I just went in the hallway. I'm in the provost office. I went in the hallway and I just burst out laughing. So much so that Provost is talking to my counterpart in her office. She's like, David, what's going on? And I went in, and as soon as I said the quarter coin program, they just dropped their stuff on the table. It's like, oh my God. You know, because you know, they're both women in underrepresented areas themselves, you know, my colleagues, you know, and they know what that means. Mm-hmm. They know exactly what that means. And this is 2024.
Yeah.
So to know that it's finally going to come out in spite of, and I just said, I want to see him just mad. but anyway, that's all I want to add.
Thank you for sharing that.
Thank you.
With the coin being approved and such through the Mint, do you have any idea what the design is going to look like? Have they provided you any conceptual art or anything like that?
It's essentially an image. It kind of reminds me, the coin reminds me of a nickel with Ben Franklin on it, like a large image of a person's face. And I like that, the one that they went with, because it's her kind of like as the mother of a project looking down on the Oliver Hazard Perry. There's the ocean that the ship is on, looks like kind of a computer graphic board. And then it says United States of America, Arkansas, Ray Montague. And there were some other ones that said Ray Montague engineer things. I thought that the image on this one really kind of stood out more as being this was a revolutionary type of thing, and that she was proud of that to contribute in that way. I'm leaving something out, but I can't think of what. But that was essentially the process.
Do either of you have any final thoughts that you would like our listeners to hear about, Ray?
Well, first of all, I want to say thank you for having us and giving us the opportunity to share with your audience Ray Montague, pioneer and internationally recognized engineer. And I emphasize that because that's what happened. Her humble beginnings, to me, so many things come to mind. For instance, where one starts out is no necessary indicator where they may end up. It just isn't. She had very humble beginnings, but boy, when she made her stride, despite all those obstacles, her career took off. Again, the importance of daring to dream, and not just the dream, but the dream and commit yourself to that dream and to stick with it until it comes to pass. You know, that's huge. Her life reminds us of the importance of childhood affirmations again. We have to encourage our children on the regular. I'm not saying, you know, I'm a humanities person. I wouldn't strive to be a surgeon. I'm not talking about that. Yeah. But my parents also taught us the same thing. You can do anything you want if you're willing to do the work. And to hear that over and over again, or if you do bump into a wall, how do you want to get past it? So I wasn't just telling you. They got your brain to work. How do you think that you want to get past that? I think we'll be talking about Ray Montague for a long time, not just because of her career, but what she was able to achieve despite the obstacles that she constantly encountered. Like I said, racism, traditionalism, and sexism permeated her career. Yes. From when she started as a GS-3 to when she was a GS-15, eligible for SES, and it was blocked. After all she had done. So she retires in January 1990. And I think, too, we didn't say it earlier, but maybe we did. In her career, not only did success not achieved alone, some of her mentors looked nothing like her. And sometimes there's a misconception when a person has a mentor that individual has to look like you.
Right.
Not true at all.
Right.
None of us would be who we are if somebody didn't take the time to invest in us, to encourage us, or to show us how we could do something better, or in some cases, to challenge us. Sometimes folks get challenges and they're so overwhelmed with the challenge, they don't know what to do with it, or they go in the opposite direction. Ray reminds us, embrace it, take it. Either way, you're going to learn something, right? You're going to be a little better off because you went through it. And usually challenges tend to build character. Challenges teach you things about yourself that you weren't aware of at all. And it teaches the people around you things about you that they didn't know. She's tremendous. She's amazing. I'm very grateful that my colleague introduced me to her. And Dr. Lupke gave me the opportunity to write the essay for the book. And I got an added blessing having to meet her son, who I'd only known through videotapes and newspaper articles. This has been very special, and I thank you very much.
Such an honor being part of this podcast tribute and the dovetail connection to the book and your amazing chapter.
Thank
Gina,
you very much. That means a lot coming from you.
Thank you. And you have so much. I learn something new about my mother all the time. The meticulous research that you did to put this together, this chapter. You know, all these years, I had met people, and thankfully, she got to meet people who had served on the Oliver Hazard Perry. In fact, the commander at Dahlgren, when we were there in 2017, we were just talking in the hallway, and he said, you know, ma'am, I just want to let you know the Oliver Hazard Perry was my first ship, you know, wow. And I took a little video of them together, you know, and I met so many other people who had served on that ship and others, but it wasn't until I read your chapter, and I made a note to look up the citation for it, because I want to read the whole thing now for that citation you found. I had no idea that the Oliver Hazard Perry not only was used by the United States, mm-hmm. but used to help other countries too. And I read it's Turkey, Egypt, Poland, Pakistan, and Spain. And that is just, that's mind-boggling to me, you know, to know that her work paid things forward. And I'll just close with this. She was not as focused on her career as she was how she helped others, but she always was very surprised, especially when she was getting her roses, especially toward the end, and people would ask her, you know, well, how do you feel? And she'd say, you know, it's great, you know, but the interesting thing is, it makes her, she said, it makes me realize that there are so many others that we do not know about, and it's just as important to know who they are too, because you think of all the contributions that they have made that have been hidden, you know, either unintentionally or intentionally, that would just be great for us to be able to add to the landscape of what we know about people. And so I think that's what I want to finish with and say she paid it forward with a career and so forth. But she really would like to see additional people be inspired by her story to want to know other stories too.
Well, I'd like to thank both of you for your time today, and especially David, taking your time out of your schedule to fly up here to Washington, D.C. from Little Rock to be part of the podcast. It's most appreciated. It's most certainly been an honor to have you here and talk about your mom and give us an account of the legacy she left behind. Gina, also been a pleasure to have you here on the podcast, and I look forward to reading your chapter on Ray in the new NHHC publication.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
We hope you've enjoyed learning about Ray Montague and her place in naval history. For more information, photos, and to read the NHHC publication that features Ray and other naval innovators, visit history.navy.mil and type podcast on the search bar. Here you can select either of the two Navy Innovators podcasts that have a direct link to the Innovator booklet, plus many other interesting references from both of these podcasts. Thanks for listening to Anchored in History, Stories of America's Navy.